Adele blushed.
What was it like?
But Ghulam had already moved on. This was often the pattern of their conversations. Ghulam choosing what they would talk about, launching into a story with gusto, roping Adele in, only to lose interest, and leave both the story and Adele dangling. Now instead of finishing up the story he had started, Ghulam said,
My grandmother says her husband, my grandfather Sabur, told her a story about this tree once. Well, that was long before he cut it down, of course. My grandfather told it to her when they were both kids. The story was that if you had a wish, you had to kneel before the tree and whisper it. And if the tree agreed to grant it, it would shed exactly 10 leaves on your head.
I never heard that,
Adele said.
Well, you wouldn't have, would you?
It was then that Adele cut onto what Ghulam had really said.
Wait, your grandfather cut down our tree?
Ghulam turned his eyes to him.
Your tree? It's not your tree.
Adele blinked.
What does that mean?
Ghulam bore his gaze even deeper into Adele's face. For the first time, Adele could detect no trace of his friend's customary liveliness or of his trademark smirk or light-hearted mischief. His face was transformed, his expression sober, startlingly adult.
This was my family's tree. This was my family's land. It's been ours for generations. Your father built his mansion on our land, while we were in Pakistan during the war.
He pointed to the orchards.
These? They used to be people's homes, but your father had them bulldozed to the ground, just like he brought down the house where my father was born, where he was raised.
Adele blinked.
He claimed our land as his own, and he built that.
Here, he actually sneered as he threw a thumb toward the compound.
That thing in his stead.
Feeling a little nauseated, his heart thumping heavily, Adele said,
I thought we were friends. Why are you telling me these terrible lies?
Remember when I tricked you and took your jersey?
Ghulam said, a flush rising to his cheeks.
You almost cried. Don't deny it. I saw you. That was over a shirt. A shirt! Imagine how my family felt coming all the way from Pakistan, only to get off the bus and find this thing on our land. And then your goon in the purple suit ordering us off our own land.
My father is not a thief,
Adele shot back.
Ask anyone in Shadbagh now. Ask them what he has done for this town.
He thought of how Babajan received people at the town mosque, reclined on the floor, teacup before him, prayer beads in hand. A solemn line of people stretching from his cushion to the front entrance. Men with muddy hands, toothless old women, young widows with children, every one of them in need, each waiting for his or her turn to ask for a favor. A job, a small loan to repair a roof, or an irrigation ditch, or buy milk formula. His father nodding, listening with infinite patience, as though each person in line mattered to him like family.
Yeah? Then how come my father has the ownership documents?
Ghulam said.
The ones he gave to the judge at the courthouse.
I'm sure if your father talks to Baba, your Baba won't talk to us. He wouldn't acknowledge what he has done. He drives past like we are stray dogs.
You are not dogs, Adele said. It was a struggle to keep his voice even.
You're buzzards, just like Kabir said. I should have known.
Ghulam stood up, took a step or two, and paused.
Just so you know,
he said,
I hold nothing against you. You are just an ignorant little boy. But next time Baba goes to Helmand, ask him to take you to that factory of his. See what he's got growing out there. I'll give you a hint.
It's not cotton.
Later that night, before dinner, Adel lay in a bath full of warm, soapy water. He could hear the TV downstairs, Kabir watching an old pirate movie. The anger which had lingered all afternoon had washed through Adel. And now he thought that he had been too rough with Ghulam. Babajan had told him once that no matter how much you did, sometimes the poor spoke ill of the rich. They mainly did it out of disappointment with their own lives. It couldn't be helped. It was natural even. And we mustn't blame them, Adel, he said. Adel was not too naive to know that the world was a fundamentally unfair place. He only had to gaze out the window of his bedroom. But he imagined that for people like Ghulam, the acknowledgement of this truth brought no satisfaction. Maybe people like Ghulam needed someone to stand culpable, a flesh and bones target, someone they could conveniently point to as the agent of their hardship, someone to condemn, blame, to be angry with. And perhaps Babajan was right when he said the proper response was to understand, to withhold judgment, to answer with kindness even. Watching little soapy bubbles come up to the surface and pop, Adel thought of his father building schools and clinics when he knew there were people in town who spread wicked gossip about him. As he was drying himself off, his mother poked her head through the bathroom door. "You're coming down for a dinner?"
"I'm not hungry," he said.
"Oh."
She came inside and grabbed the towel off the rack.
"Here, sit. Let me dry your hair."
"I can do it myself,"
Adel said. She stood behind him, her eyes studying him in the mirror.
"Are you all right, Adel?"
He shrugged. She rested a hand on his shoulder and looked at him as if expecting him to rub his cheek against it. He didn't.
"Mother, have you ever seen Baba John's factory?"
He noticed the pause in his mother's movements.
"Of course,"
she said.
"So have you. I don't mean pictures. Have you actually seen it? Been to it?" "How could I?"
his mother said, tilting her head in the mirror.
"Helmand is unsafe. Your father would never put me or you in harm's way."
Adel nodded. Downstairs, cannons blasted, and pirates hollered their war cries. 3 days later, Ghulam showed up again. He walked briskly up to Adel and stopped.
"I'm glad you came,"
Adel said.
"I have something for you."
From the top of the tree stump, he fetched the coat he had been bringing with him daily since their spat. It was a chocolate brown leather with a soft sheepskin lining and a hood that could be zippered on and off. He extended it to Ghulam.
"I've only worn it a few times. It's a little big for me. It should fit you."
Ghulam didn't make a move.
"We took a bus to Kabul and went to the courthouse yesterday," he said flatly. "Guess what the judge told us? He said he had bad news. He said there was an accident, a small fire. My father's ownership documents burned in it. Gone. Destroyed."
Adel slowly dropped the hand holding the jacket.
"And as he's telling us that there's nothing he can do now without the papers, do you know what he has on his wrist? A brand new gold watch he wasn't wearing the last time my father saw him."
Adel blinked. Ghulam flicked his gaze to the coat. It was a cutting, punishing look, meant to inflict shame. It worked. Adel shrunk. In his hand, he felt the coat shifting, transforming from peace offering to bribe. Ghulam spun around and hurried back toward the road in brisk, busy steps. The evening of the same day that he returned, Babajan threw a party at the house. Adele was sitting now beside his father at the head of the big cloth that had been spread on the floor for the meal. Babacan sometimes preferred to sit on the ground and to eat with his fingers, especially if he was seeing friends from his jihadi years. "Reminds me of the cave days," he joked. The women were eating at the table in the dining room with spoons and forks. Adele's mother seated at the head. Adele could hear their chatter echoing off the marble walls. One of them, a thick-hipped woman with long hair dyed red, was engaged to be married to one of Babacan's friends. Earlier in the evening, she had shown Adele's mother pictures on her digital camera of the bridal shop they had visited in Dubai. Over tea, after the meal, Babacan told a story about the time his unit had ambushed a Soviet column to stop it from entering a valley up north. Everyone listened closely. "When they entered the kill zone," Babacan said, one hand absently stroking Adele's hair, "we opened fire. We hit the lead vehicle, then a few jeeps. I thought they would back out or try to plow through. But the sons of whores stopped, dismounted, and engaged us in gunfire. Can you believe it?" A murmur spread around the room. Heads shook. Adele knew that at least half the men in the room were former Mujahideen. "We outnumbered them, maybe 3-1. But they had heavy weaponry, and it wasn't long before they were attacking us, attacking our positions in the orchards. Soon everybody was scattered. We ran for it. Me and this guy, Muhammad, something or other. We ran together. We are running side by side in a field of grapevines. Not the kind on posts and wires, but the kind that people let grow out on the ground. Bullets are flying everywhere, and we are running for our lives, and suddenly we both trip and go down. In a second flat, I'm back on my feet running. But there's no sign of this guy Muhammad something or other. I turn and yell, 'Get the hell up, you donkey's ass!'" Babacan paused for dramatic effects. He pushed a fist to his lips to fight laughter.
"And then he pops up and starts running, and would you believe it? This crazy son of a whore is carrying 2 armfuls of grapes. 1 month in each arm."
Laughter erupted. Adele laughed too. His father rubbed his back and pulled him close. Someone started to tell another story, and Babacan reached for the cigarette sitting next to his plate. But he never got a chance to light it because suddenly glass shattered somewhere in the house. From the dining room, women screamed. Something metallic, maybe a fork or a butter knife, clanged loudly on the marble. The men bolted to their feet. Asmarai and Kabir came running into the room, handguns already drawn.
"It came from the entrance," Kabir said.
And just as he said this, glass broke again.
"Wait here, Commander Sahib. We will have a look," Asmarai said.
"Like hell I will," Babacan growled, already pushing forward. "I'm not cowering under my own roof."
He headed toward the foyer, trailed by Adele, Asmarai, Kabir, and all the male guests. On their way, Adele saw Kabir pick up a metal rod they use in the winter to stoke the fire in the stove. Adele saw his mother too as she ran to join them, her face pale and drawn. When they reached the foyer, a rock came flying through the window and shards of glass crashed to the floor. The woman with red hair, the bride-to-be, screamed. Outside, someone was yelling.
"How the hell did they get past the guard?"
someone said behind Adele.
"Commander Sahib, no!"
Kabir barked. But Adele's father had already opened the front door. The light was dimming, but it was summer, and the sky was still awash in pale yellow. In the distance, Adele saw little clusters of light, people in Shalbaba now settling in for dinner with their families. The hills running along the horizon had darkened, and soon night would fill in all the hollows. But it wasn't dark enough, not yet, to shroud the old man Adelso standing at the foot of the front steps, a rock in each hand. "Take him upstairs," Babacan said over his shoulder to Adele's mother. "Now!" Adele's mother led him up the staircase by the shoulders, down the hallway, and into the master bedroom she shared with Babacan. She closed the door, locked it, pulled the curtains shut, and turned on the TV. She guided Adele to the bed, and together they sat. On the screen, two Arabs dressed in long Kurta shirts and knit caps were working on the monster truck. "What is he going to do to that old man?" Adele said. He couldn't stop from shivering. "Mother, what is he going to do to him?" He looked up at his mother and saw a cloud pass over her face, and he suddenly knew. He knew right away that whatever came out of her mouth next could not be trusted. "He's going to talk to him," she said with a tremor. "He's going to reason with whoever is out there. It's what your father does. He reasons with people." Adele shook his head. He was weeping now, sobbing. "What is he going to do, mother? What is he going to do to that old man?" His mother kept saying the same thing, that everything was going to be all right, that it would all turn out just fine, that no one was going to get hurt. But the more she said it, the more he sobbed, until it exhausted him. At some point, he fell asleep on his mother's lap. Former Commander Scapes Assassination Attempt. Adol read the story in his father's study, on his father's computer. The story described the attack as vicious and the assailant as a former refugee with suspected ties to the Taliban. Midway through the article, Adele's father was quoted as saying that he had feared for the safety of his family. "Especially my innocent little boy," he had said. The article gave no name to the assailant, nor any indication of what had happened to him. Adele shut off the computer. He wasn't supposed to be using it, and he had trespassed, coming into his father's study. A month ago, he wouldn't have dared do either. He trudged back into his room, lay on his bed, and bounced an old tennis ball against the wall. Thump, thump, thump. It wasn't long before his mother poked her head in through the door and asked, then told him to stop. But he didn't. She lingered at the door for a while before slinking away. Thump, thump, thump. On the surface, nothing had changed. A transcript of Adele's daily activities would have revealed him falling back into a normal rhythm. He still got up at the same hour, washed, had breakfast with his parents, lessons with his tutor. Afterward, he ate lunch and then spent the afternoon lying around, watching movies with Kabir or else playing video games. But nothing was the same. Olam may have cracked a door open to him, but it was Babacan who had pushed him through it. Dormant gears in Adele's mind had begun to turn. Adele felt as though overnight he had acquired an altogether new auxiliary sense, one that empowered him to perceive things he never had before, things that had stared him in the face for years. He saw, for instance, how his mother has secrets inside of her. When he looked at her, they practically rippled over her face. He saw her struggles to keep from him all the things she knew, all the things she kept locked up, closed off, carefully guarded, like the two of them in this big house. He saw for the first time his father's house for the monstrosity, the affront, the monument to injustice that it privately was to everyone else. He saw in people's rush to please his father the intimidation, the fear. That was the real underpinning of their respect and deference. He thought Ghulam would be proud of him for this insight. For the first time, Adel felt truly aware of the broader movements that had always governed his life, and of the wildly conflicting truths that reside within a person, not just in his father or his mother or Kabir, but within himself too. This last discovery was in some ways the most surprising to Adel. The revelations of what he now knew his father had done, first in the name of jihad, then for what he had called the just rewards of sacrifice, had left Adel reeling, at least for a while. For days after that evening, the rocks had come crashing through the window. Adele's stomach ached whenever his father walked into the room. He found his father barking into his mobile phone, or even heard him humming in the bath, and he felt his spine crumpling, his throat going painfully dry. His father kissed him goodnight, and Adele's instinct was to recoil. He had nightmares. He dreamt he was standing at the edge of the orchards, watching it thrashing about among the trees, the glint of a metal rod rising and falling, the sound of metal striking meat and bone. He woke from these dreams with a howl locked in his chest. Bouts of weeping sideswiped him at random moments. And yet, something else was happening as well. The new awareness had not faded from his mind, but slowly had found company. Another opposing current of consciousness coursed through him now, one that did not displace the first, but claimed space beside it. Adel felt an awakening to this other, more troubling part of himself, the part of him that over time would gradually, almost imperceptibly, accept this new identity that at present prickled like a wet wool sweater. Adel saw that in the end he would probably accept things as his mother had. Adel had been angry with her at first. He was more forgiving now. Perhaps she had accepted out of fear of her husband, or as a bargain for the life of luxury she led. Mostly, Adel suspected, she had accepted for the same reason he would, because she had to. What choice was there? Adel could not run from his life any more than Ghulam could from his. People learned to live with the most unimaginable things, as would he. This was his life, this was his mother, this was his father, and this was him, even if he hadn't always known it. Adel knew he would not love his father again as he had before, when he would sleep happily curled in the bay of his thick arms. That was inconceivable now. But he would learn to love him again, even if now it was a different, more complicated, messier business. Adel could almost feel himself leapfrogging over childhood. Soon he would land as an adult. And when he did, there would be no going back, because adulthood was akin to what his father had once said about being a war hero. Once you became one, you died one. Lying in bed at night, Adel thought that one day, maybe the next day, or the one after that, or maybe one day the following week, he would leave the house and walk over to the field by the windmill, where Ghulam had told him his family was squalling. He thought he would find the field empty. He would stand on the side of the road, picture Ghulam and his mother and his brothers and his grandmother, the family, a straggling line, lugging roped-up belongings, padding along the dusty shoulders of country roads, looking for some place to land. Ghulam was the head of the family now. He would have to work. He would now spend his youth clearing canals, digging ditches, making bricks, and harvesting fields. Ghulam would gradually turn into one of those stooping leather-faced men Adel always saw behind plows. Adel thought he would stand there a while in the field, watching the hills and mountains looming over New Shotbah. and then he thought he would reach into his pocket for what he had found one day walking through the orchards. The left half of a pair of spectacles snapped at the bridge, the lens a spider web of cracks, the temple crusted with dried blood. He would toss the broken spectacles into a ditch. Adele suspected that as he turned back around and walked home, what he would feel mostly would be relief.
Chapter 8, Fall 2010.
This evening I come home from the clinic and find a message from Talia on the landline phone in my bedroom. I play it as I slip off my shoes and sit at my desk. She tells me she has a cold. When she is sure, she picked up from Mama. Then she asks after me. Asks how work is going in Kabul. At the end, just before she hangs up, she says,
Odi goes on and on about how you don't call. Of course she won't tell you, so I will. Marcus, for the love of Christ, call your mother, you ass.
I smile. Talia.
I keep a picture of her on my desk. The one I took all those years ago at the beach on Tinas. Talia sitting on the rock with her back to the camera. I have framed the photo, though if you look closely, you can still see a patch of dark brown on the right lower corner, courtesy of a crazy Italian girl who tried to set fire to it many years ago. I turn on my laptop and start typing up the previous day's up notes. My room is upstairs, one of the three bedrooms on the second floor of this house where I have lived since my arrival in Kabul back in 2002, and my desk sits at the window overlooking the garden below. I have a view of the loquat trees my old landlord Nabi and I planted a few years ago. I can see Nabi's one-time quarters along the back wall too, now repainted. After he passed away, I offered them to a young Dutch fellow who helps local high schools with their IT. And off to the right, there is Suleiman Wahdati's 1940 Chevrolet, unmoved for decades, shrouded in rust like a rock by moss, currently covered by a light film of yesterday's surprisingly early snowfall, the first of the year thus far. After Nabi died, I thought briefly of having the car hauled to one of Kabul's junkyards, but I didn't have the heart. It seemed to me too essential a part of the house's past, its history. I finished the notes and checked my watch. It's already 9:30 p.m., 7 o'clock in the evening back in Greece.
Call your mother, you ass!
If I'm going to call Mama tonight, I can't delay it any longer. I remember Talia wrote in one of her emails that Mama was going to bed earlier and earlier. I take a breath and steel myself. I pick up the receiver and dial. I met Talia in the summer of 1967, when I was 12 years old. She and her mother Madeline came to Tinas to visit Mama and me. Mama, whose name is Odilia, said it had been years, 15 to be exact, since she and her friend Madeline had last seen each other. Madeline had left the island at 17 and gone off to Athens to become, for a brief time at least, an actress of some modest renown. I wasn't surprised, Mama said, when I heard of her acting. Because of her looks, everyone was always taken with Madeline. You will see for yourself when you meet her. I asked Mama why she'd never mentioned her.
Haven't I? Are you sure?
I am sure. I could have sworn. Then she said,
The daughter? Talia, you must be considered with her because she had an accident. A dog bit her. She has a scar.
Mama wouldn't say more, and I knew better than to lean on her about it. But this revelation intrigued me far more than Madeline's past in film and stage had. My curiosity fueled by the suspicion that the scar must be both significant and visible for the girl to deserve special consideration. With morbid eagerness, I looked forward to seeing the scar for myself.
Madeline and I met at Mass when we were little,
Mama said. Right off, she said, they had become inseparable friends. They had held hands under the desks in class, or at recess, at church, or strolling past the barley fields. They had sworn to remain sisters for life. They promised they would live close to each other, even after they had married. They would live as neighbors, and if one or the other's husband insisted on moving away, then they would demand a divorce. I remember that Mama grinned a little when she told me all this self-mockingly, as if to distance herself from this youthful exuberance and foolishness, all those headlong, breathless vows. But I saw in her face a tinge of unspoken hurt as well, a shade of disappointment that Mama was far too proud to admit to. Madeline was married now to a wealthy and much older man, Messer Andreas Giannakos, who years before had produced her second and, as it turned out, last film. He was in the construction business now and owned a big firm in Athens. They had had a falling out recently, a row, Madeline and Mr. Giannakos. Mama didn't tell me any of this information. I knew it from a clandestine, hasty partial read of the letter Madeline had sent Mama informing her of her intent to visit. It grows so tiresome, I tell you, to be around Andreas and his right-wing friends and their martial music. I keep tight-lipped all the time. I say nothing when they exalt these military thugs who have made a mockery of our democracy. Should I utter so much as a word of dissent, I'm confident they will label me a communist anarchist. And then even Andreas's influence would not save me from the dungeons. Perhaps he would not bother exerting it, meaning his influence. Sometimes I believe it's precisely his intent to provoke me into impugning myself. Ah, how I miss you, my dear Odie. How I miss your company. The day our guests were due to arrive, Mama awoke early to tidy up. We lived in a small house built into a hillside. Like many houses in Tinos, it was made of whitewashed stone, and the roof was flat with diamond-shaped red tiles. The small upstairs bedroom Mama and I shared didn't have a door. The narrow stairwell led right into it, but it did have a fanlight window and a narrow terrace with a waist-high wrought iron balustrade from which you could look out on the roofs of other houses, on the olive trees and the goats and winding stone alleys and arches below. And of course the Aegean, blue and calm in the summer morning, white-capped in the afternoon with the melting winds blew in from the north. When she was done cleaning up, Mama put on what passed for her one fancy outfit. The one she wore every August 15, the Feast of Dormition at the Panagia Evangelistaria Church. When pilgrims descended on Tinos from everywhere in the Mediterranean to pray before the church's famed icon. There is a photo of my mother in that outfit. A long, drab, rusty gold dress with a rounded neckline, the shrunken white sweater, the stockings, the clunky black shoes. Mama looking every bit the forbidden widow, with her severe face, her tufted eyebrows, and her snub nose. Standing stiffly, looking sullenly pious, like she is a pilgrim herself. I am in the picture too, standing rigidly at my mother's hip. I'm wearing a white shirt, white shorts, and white knee socks rolled up. You can tell by my scowl that I have been ordered to stand straight, to not smile. That my face has been scrubbed and my hair combed down with water against my will and with a great deal of fuss. You can sense a current of dissatisfaction between us. You see it in how rigidly we stand, how our bodies barely make contact. Or maybe you can't, but I do every time I see that picture. the last time being 2 years ago. I can't help but see the weariness, the effort, the impatience. I can't help but see two people together out of a sense of genetic duty, doomed already to bewilder and disappoint each other, each honor-bound to defy the other. From the bedroom window upstairs, I watch Mama leave for the ferry port in the town of Tinas. A scarf tied under the chin, Mama rammed into the sunny blue day head first. She was a slight, small-boned woman with the body of a child, but when you saw her coming, you did well to let her pass. I remember her walking me to school every morning. My mother is retired now, but she was a school teacher. As we walked, Mama never held my hand. The other mothers did with their own kids, but not Mama. She says she had to treat me like any other student. She marched ahead, a fist closed at the neck of her sweater, and I tried to keep up, lunchbox in hand, tottering along behind in her footsteps. In the classroom, I always sat at the back. I remember my mother at the blackboard and how she could nail a misbehaving pupil with a single scolding glance, like a rock from a slingshot, the aim surgically through. And she could cleave you in half with nothing but a dark look or a sudden beat of silence. Mama believed in loyalty above all, even at the cost of self-denial, especially at the cost of self-denial. She also believed it was always best to tell the truth, to tell it plainly, without fanfare, and the more disagreeable the truth, the sooner you had to tell it. She had no patience for soft spines. She was, is, a woman of enormous will, a woman without apology, and not a woman with whom you want to have a dispute. Though I have never really understood, even now, whether her temperament was God-given or one she adopted out of necessity, what with her husband dying barely a year into their marriage and leaving her to raise me all on her own. I fell asleep upstairs a short while after Mama left. I jolted awake later to the woman's high, ringing voice. I sat up and there she was, all lipstick, powder, perfume, and slender curves, an airline ad smiling down at me through the thin veil of a pillbox hat. She stood in the middle of the room in the neon green mini dress, leather valise at her feet, with the auburn hair and long limbs, grinning down at me, a shine on her face, and talking, the seams of her voice bursting with aplomb and cheer.
"So you're Odie's little Marcus.
She didn't tell me you were this handsome. Oh, and I see her in you. Around the eyes? Yes, you have the same eyes. I think, I'm sure you have been told. I've been so eager to meet you. Your mother and I, we... Oh, no doubt Odie has told you. So you can imagine, you can picture... What a thrill this is for me, to see the two of you, to meet you, Marcus, Marcus Varvaris. Well, I'm Madeline Ginnakus, and may I say I'm delighted. She took off a cream-colored, elbow-length satin glove, the kind I'd seen worn only in magazines by elegant ladies out at the soiree, smoking on the wide steps of the opera house, or being helped out of a shiny black car, their faces lit up by popping flashbulbs. She had to yank on each fingertip a bunch of times before the glove came off, and then she stooped slightly at the waist and offered me her hand.
"Charmed," she said.
Her hand was soft and cool despite the glove. "And this is my daughter, Talia. Darling, say hello to Marcus Varvaris." She stood at the entrance of the room beside my mother, looking at me blankly, a lanky, pale-skinned girl with limp curls. Other than that, I can't tell you a single thing. I can't tell you the color of the dress she wore that day, that is, if she wore a dress, or the style of her shoes, or whether she had socks on, or whether she wore a watch, or a necklace, or a ring, or a pair of earrings. I can tell you, because if you were at a restaurant and someone suddenly stripped, hopped atop a table, and started juggling dessert spoons, you would not only look, it would be the only thing you could look at. The mask draped over the lower half of the girl's face was like that. It obliterated the possibility of any other observation.
Talia, say hello, darling. Don't be rude.
I thought I saw a faint nod of the head.
Hello,
I replied with a sandpaper tongue. There was a ripple in the air, a current. I felt charged with something that was half thrill, half dread, something that burst upward inside me and coiled itself up. I was staring, and I knew it, and I couldn't stop. Couldn't peel my gaze away from the sky blue cloth of the mask. The two sets of bands tying it to the back of her head. The narrow horizontal slit over the mouth. I knew right then that I couldn't bear to see it, whatever the mask was hiding, and that I couldn't wait to see it. Nothing in my life could resume its natural course and rhythm and order until I saw for myself what was so terrible, so dreadful, that I and others had to be protected from it. The alternate possibility that the mask was perhaps designed to shield Talia from us eluded me. At least it did in the dizzying throes of that first meeting. Madeleine and Talia stayed upstairs to unpack, while Mama buttered up cuts of sole for supper in the kitchen. She asked me to make Madeleine a cup of El Nico's Café, which I did, and she asked me to take it up to her, which I did as well, on a tray with a little plate of pastelli. All these decades later, and shame still washes over me like some warm, sticky liquid at the memory of what happened next. To this day, I can picture the scene like a photograph. Frozen, Madeleine smoking, standing at the bedroom window, looking at the sea through a set of T-shaped glasses with yellow lenses, one hand on her hip, ankles crossed. Her pillbox hat sits on the dresser. Above the dresser is a mirror, and in the mirror is Talia, sitting on the edge of the bed, her back to me. She's stooped down, doing something, maybe undoing her shoelaces, and I can see that she has removed her mask, is sitting next to her on the bed. A thread of cold marches down my spine, and I try to stop it, but my hands tremble, which makes the porcelain cup clink on the saucer, which makes Madeleine turn her head from the window to me, which makes Talia look up. I catch her reflection in the mirror. The tray slipped from my hands, porcelain shattered. Hot liquid spilled and the tray went clanking down the steps. It was sudden mayhem. Me on all fours, retching all over shards of broken porcelain, Madeleine saying, "Oh dear, oh dear," and Mama running upstairs yelling, "What happened? What did you do, Marcos?" A dog bit her, Mama had told me by way of a warning. She has a scar. The dog hadn't beaten Talia's face. It had eaten it. And perhaps there were words to describe what I saw in the mirror that day. But scar wasn't one of them. I remember Mama's hands grabbing my shoulders, her pulling me up and whirling me around saying, "What is it with you? What is wrong with you?" And I remember her gaze lifting over my head. It froze there. The words died in her mouth. She went blank in the face. Her hands dropped from my shoulders. And then I witnessed the most extraordinary thing. Something I thought I would no sooner see than King Constantine himself turning up at our door dressed in a clown suit. A single tear swelling at the edge of my mother's right eye.
"So what was she like?"
Mama asked. "Who?"
"Who? The French woman, your landlord's niece, the professor from Paris."
I switched the receiver to my other ear. It surprises me that she remembers. All my life, I've had the feeling that the words I say to Mama vanish unheard in space, as if there is a static between us, a bad connection. Sometimes when I call her from Kabul, as I have now, I feel as though she has quietly lowered the receiver and stepped away, and that I'm speaking into a void across the continents, and though I can feel my mother's presence on the line and hear her breathing in my ear. Other times, I'm telling her about something I saw at the clinic. Some bloodied boy carried by his father, for instance. Shrapnel embedded deep in his cheeks, ear torn clean off. Another victim of playing on the wrong street at the wrong time of the wrong day. And then, without warning, a loud clunk, a mama's voice suddenly distant and muffled, rising and falling, the echo of footsteps, of something being dragged across the floor, and I clam up, wait until she comes back on. Which she does, eventually, always a bit out of breath, explaining, "I told her I was fine standing up. I said it clearly. I said, 'Talia, I would like to stand at the window and look down on the water as I'm talking to Marcos.' But she says, 'You will tire yourself out, Odie. You need to sit.' Next thing I know, she's dragging the armchair. This big leather thing she bought me last year, she's dragging it to the window. My God, she's strong. You haven't seen the armchair. Of course, well, of course." She then sighs with mock exasperation and asks that I go on with my story. But by then, I'm too unbalanced to. The net effect is that she has made me feel vaguely reprimanded, and, what's more, deserving of it, guilty of wrongs unspoken, offenses I've never been formally charged with. Even if I do go on with my story, it sounds diminished to my own ears. It doesn't measure up to Mama's armchair drama with Talia.
"What was her name again?"
Mama says now.
"Perry something, no?"
I've told Mama about Nabi, who was a dear friend to me. She knows the general outline of his life only. She knows that in his will, he left the Kabul house to his niece, Perry, who was raised in France. But I have not told Mama about Nila Wahdati, her escape to Paris after her husband's stroke, the decades Nabi spent caring for Suleiman. That history, too many boomeranging parallels. Like reading aloud your own indictment. "Perry, yes, she was nice," I say, "and warm, especially for an academic."
What is she again? A chemist?
"Mathematician," I say, closing the lid of the laptop. It has started snowing again. Lightly, tiny flecks twisting in the dark, flinging themselves at my window. I tell Mama about Perry Wahdati's visit late this past summer. She really was quite lovely. Gentle, slim, gray hair, long neck with a full blue vein crawling up each side, warm gap-toothed smile. She seemed a bit brittle, older than her age. Bad rheumatoid arthritis. The nubby hands especially. Still functional, but the day is coming, and she knew it. It made me think of Mama and the coming of her day. Perry Wahdati stayed a week with me at the house in Kabul. I gave her a tour of it when she arrived from Paris. She had last seen the house back in 1955 and seemed quite surprised at the vividness of her own memory of the place, its general layout. The two steps between the living room and dining room, for instance, where she said she would sit in a band of sunlight mid-mornings and read her books. She was struck by how much smaller the house really was, compared to the version of it in her memory. When I took her upstairs, she knew which had been her bedroom, though it's currently taken up by a German colleague of mine who works for the World Food Program. I remember her breath catching when she spotted the short litter armoire in the corner of the bedroom. one of the few surviving relics of her childhood. I remembered it from the note that Nabi had left me prior to his death. She squatted next to it and ran her fingertips over the cheap yellow paint and over the fading drafts and long-tailed monkeys on its doors. When she looked up at me, I saw that her eyes had teared a little, and she asked, very shyly and apologetically, if it would be possible to have it shipped to Paris. She offered to pay for a replacement. It was the only thing she wanted from the house. I told her it would be my pleasure to do it. In the end, other than the armoire, which I had shipped a few days after her departure, Paris Wahdati returned to France with nothing but Suleiman Wahdati's sketchpads, Nabi's letter, and a few of her mother, Nila's poems, which Nabi had saved. The only other thing she asked of me during her stay was to arrange a ride to take her to Schottbach so she could see the village where she had been born and where she hoped to find her half-brother, Iqbal.
I assume she will sell the house, Mama says, now that it's hers.
She said I could stay on as long as I liked, actually. I say,
rent-free.
I can all but see Mama's lips tighten skeptically. She is an islander. She suspects the motives of all mainlanders.
Looks askance at their apparent acts of goodwill.
This was one of the reasons I knew, when I was a boy, that I would leave Tinas one day when I had a chance. A kind of despair used to get hold of me whenever I heard people talking this way. How's the dovecot coming along? I asked to change the subject.
I had to give it a rest. It tired me out.
Mama was diagnosed in Athens 6 months ago by neurologists I had insisted she see, after Talia told me Mama was twitching and dropping things all the time. It was Talia who took her. Since the trip to the neurologist, Mama has been on a tear. I know this through the emails Talia sends me. Repainting the house, fixing water leaks, coaxing Talia into helping her build a whole new closet upstairs, even replacing cracked shingles on the roof. Though thankfully, Talia put an end to that. Now the dovecote. I picture Mama with her sleeves rolled high, hammer in hand, sweat staining her back, pounding nails and standing planks of wood, racing against her own failing neurons, wringing every last drop of use from them while there's still time.
When are you coming home?
Mama says. Soon, I say. Soon was what I said the year before too, when she asked me the same question. It has been 2 years since my last visit to Tinas. A brief pause.
Don't wait too long. I want to see you before they strap me in the iron lung.
She laughs. This is an old habit. This joke-making and clowning in the face of bad luck, this disdain of hers for the slightest show of self-pity. It has the paradoxical, and I know calculated, effect of both shrinking and augmenting the misfortune.
Come for Christmas if you can, she says. Before the 4th of January, at any rate. Talia says there is going to be a solar eclipse over Greece that day. She read it on the internet. We could watch it together.
I will try, Mama, I say. It was like waking up one morning and finding that a wild animal has wandered into your house. No place felt safe to me. She was there at every corner and turn, prowling, stalking, forever dabbing at her cheek with a handkerchief to dry the dribble that constantly flow from her mouth. The small dimensions of our house rendered escape from her impossible. I especially dreaded mealtime when I had to endure the spectacle of Talia lifting the bottom of the mask to deliver spoonfuls of food to her mouth. My stomach turned at the sight and at the sound. She ate noisily, bits of half-chewed food always falling with a wet splat onto her plate, or the table, or even the floor. She was forced to take all liquids, even soup, through a straw, of which her mother kept a stash in her purse. She slurped and gurgled when she sucked broth up the straw, and it always stained the mask and dripped down the side of her jaw onto her neck. The first time, I asked to be excused from the table, and Mama shot me a hard look. And so I trained myself to avert my gaze and not hear, but it wasn't easy. I would walk into the kitchen, and there she would be, sitting still while Madeline rubbed ointment onto her cheek to prevent chafing. I began keeping a calendar, a mental countdown of the 4 weeks Mama had said Madeline and Talia were staying. I wished Madeline had come by herself. I liked Madeline just fine. We sat, the four of us, in the small square-shaped courtyard outside our front door, and she sipped coffee and smoked cigarettes one after another. The angles of her face shaded by her olive tree and a gold straw cloche that should have looked absurd on her would have on anyone else, like Mama, for instance. But Madeline was one of those people to whom elegance came effortlessly, as though it were a genetic skill, like the ability to curl your tongue into the shape of a tube. With Madeline, there was never a lull in the conversation. Stories just thrilled out of her. One morning she told us about her travels to Ankara, for instance, where she had strolled the banks of the Inguri Su and sipped green tea laced with raki. Or the time she and Mr. Giannakos had gone to Kenya and ridden the backs of elephants among thorny acacias and even sat down to eat cornmeal mush and coconut rice with the local villagers. Madeline's stories stirred up an old restlessness in me, an urge I'd always had to strike out headlong into the world, to be dauntless. By comparison, my own life on Tina seemed crushingly ordinary. I foresaw my life unfolding as an interminable stretch of nothingness, and so I spent most of my childhood years on Tina's floundering, feeling like a stand-in for myself, a proxy, as though my real self resided elsewhere, waiting to unite someday with this dimmer, more hollow self. I felt marooned, an exile in my own home. Madeline said that in Ankara, she had gone to a place called Gulu Park and watched swans gliding in the water. She said the water was dazzling. "I'm rhapsodizing," she said, laughing. "You're not," Mama said. "It's an old habit. I talk too much. I always did. You remember how much grief I'd bring us, chattering in class?" "You were never at fault, Odie. You were so responsible and studious." "They're interesting, your stories. You have an interesting life." Madeline rolled her eyes. "Well, you know the Chinese curse." "Did you like Africa?" Mama asked Talia. Talia pressed a handkerchief to her cheek and didn't answer. I was glad. She had the oddest speech. There was a wet quality to it, a strange mix of lisp and gargle. "Oh, Talia doesn't like to travel," Madeline said, crushing her cigarette. She said this like it was the unassailable truth. There was no looking to Talia for confirmation or protest. "She hasn't got a taste for it."
"Well, neither do I,"
Mama said again to Talia.
"I like being home. I guess I've just never found a compelling reason to leave Tina's."
"And I want to stay," Madeline said. "Other than you, naturally."
She touched Mama's wrist.
"You know my worst fear when I left, my biggest worry? How am I going to get on without Odie?"
"I swear, I was petrified at the thought."
"You've managed fine, it seems,"
Mama said slowly, dragging her gaze from Talia.
"You don't understand,"
Madeline said, and I realized I was the one who didn't understand because she was looking directly at me.
"I wouldn't have kept it together without your mother. She saved me."
"Now you're rhapsodizing,"
Mama said. Talia upturned her face. She was squinting. A jet, up in the blue, silently marking its trajectory with a long, single vapor trail.
It was my father, Madeline said, that Odie saved me from.
I wasn't sure if she was still addressing me.
He was one of those people who are born mean.